Mr. Arnold, how are we, sir?
Doing all right. Dog days of summer. You know how it is.
I can feel it shifting. People, at least here in the States, I don't know what the Europeans are doing. They're probably still away, not thinking about anything. But I'm beginning to see people talk about, like, okay, it's time to lock in and focus. Kids are going back for fall sports practice. People are getting engaged.
People are getting engaged. Is that a common signal of work returning?
Yeah. People are engaging more.
I see.
But I'm looking forward to it. I love summer, but it is a chaotic season for me because we go down the shore, as you know, and you're supposed to go relax, but we don't really relax as much as we should. The kids are relaxing, but on that,
you don't have vacations with kids. It's everything is a trip, you know? So it's very active.
Very active. It's a game of survival, if you will. Speaking of which, we're officially a Straight In From Brews podcast at this point. I feel like the last 6 months, it's the recurring theme. Guess what? It remains blocked.
Shocker.
I sent out a tweet last week of from Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. It's Groundhog Day again.
Yeah, look, I never thought that if you did like a word cloud on the timestamp newsletter, that Hormuz would be like the most commonly used. It's like Bitcoin and Hormuz is like, I think, the two biggest clouds right now. But here we are, same as it ever was over the last, call it, 6 months. We've got our president saying he's going to turn the Strait of Hormuz into another U.S. territory. So you can expect the Trump Karg Island to open shortly. Both of them going back and forth saying each side is in control, insisting that they have control, they have the power. So yeah, remains basically a summer doldrum stalemate there.
Yeah. And do you think this resolves anytime soon?
You know, I'm increasingly less optimistic that you see definitive resolution on this through the end of the year. But, you know, a lot of it, I think, is going to come down to some of the dynamics we'll talk about on the rest of these slides. But you've clearly got multiple factions. We've talked about this a little bit on the show over the past couple months, but multiple factions in Iran of decision makers, some who are more pragmatic and willing to move negotiations forward and looking for a deal, probably acknowledging some of the pain being wrought by Treasury sanctions, which are apparently getting stepped up even further to the double secret sanctions tier per Bessent this week. But you've got kind of a contingency feeling that and wanting to move forward. And then you've got the IRGC who are, depending on who you talk to, you know, if you talk to Tom Luongo, that's just an arm of City of London. But whether you believe that or not, they are certainly much more intransigent. So it kind of depends, I think, on how much economic pain is actually being wrought behind the scenes that we're not totally privy to, and how that affects kind of the relative standing of those two factions and who kind of has the upper hand to move things forward. But I've, you know, very much learned to think about this as a 2 weeks TM situation for the time being.
It is. And as we've been saying for months, the signal to keep your eye on while all this is unfolding or continuing to go in a Groundhog Day like circle is what's going on in the bond markets. We currently have the U.S. 30-year trading at 5.279 and the 10-year at 4.7. So elevated, rising, seems to have broken the structural bull market that we had in bonds for 40 years, I think, cleanly. It looks like the trend has reversed over the last couple of years. But one thing we've been pointing out is to make sure that you're juxtaposing those rising yields with this Bank of America U.S. bond market option volatility index, the MOVE index. And it seems relatively suppressed. We've been tracking this pretty closely for the last 3 months, and it looks like it's falling quite a bit and settling in a range.
Yeah. And I think this is, you know, goes to your question. This is kind of one of the reasons that I also don't know that you see, as long as you have this kind of MOVE downtrend, you know, relatively intact. I think that's one less reason for the U.S. to kind of take a bad deal just to get it all over with. And, you know, I think this is, we've talked about this in the past, but this is just kind of a measure of Treasury volatility. And I think there's increasing reason to believe that the real binding constraint, the real governor on the Treasury and on the U.S. government kind of in turn is not so much the absolute level of yields, although in the long run, that does matter. And we'll talk about some interesting math there in a couple slides. But in the near term, kind of what you need is for this not to blow out so that various carry trades, treasury based trade, et cetera, can be preserved and not blow up and cause, you know, a really negative feedback loop that actually leads to kind of a crisis scenario. You've seen, you know, big spikes in the past cause some frogginess, or what was it Trump said last year, some queasiness in the bond market on Liberation Day that led to kind of the initial what was viewed as a taco. Perhaps that's right, perhaps that's wrong. But in any case, clearly, in the near term, this is the main dynamic, I think, to watch, and kind of keeping this pounded down allows for a lot more breathing room as yields probably continue to structurally rise, or at least kind of stay, you know, where they are. And so I think it's related as well to the top chart or the top slide that we just scrolled past with the SPR drain. You know, we've talked over the past few weeks or past few months about the US SPR, Strategic Petroleum Reserve, coming down to 40 plus year lows. And obviously, you know, that's not what you want to see, not ideal, in the same way that, for 4 to 5% plus kind of yields on the 10-year, 30-year, the long end are also not what you want to see. I think both of those can be manageable in the near term as it relates to oil, because the U.S. is in, you know, a net producer, net exporter position. And I think it's pretty clear based on executive orders we've seen this year that that's going up, not down, in terms of, you know, government backstops for and support for the energy industry broadly. And then on the bond side, the other big piece, it's kind of, the two things are obviously related, because higher energy prices lead to, you know, we'll tend to push yields higher and potentially increase bond volatility. If there are steps on the margin that can be taken to keep this manageable, then you extend your runway to do the what should we call it, the ego contest, for lack of a more polite term, between Trump and the IRGC, that extends the U.S.'s runway to kind of posture and play this game of chicken for longer. So those are both kind of the two dynamics that I'd be watching. And I don't yet see like the desperation on the U.S. side to kind of cry uncle here.
No, neither do I. And while all that's going on, we have Japan needing some help, and the U.S. has stepped in to purchase yen for the first time in some time. And similarly, over across the Pacific in Japan, they're losing control of their yield curve, and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent came out, I believe a few days ago, basically reiterating that the U.S. is here to support Japan in their efforts to manage this bond situation they find themselves in.
Yeah, and this is directly related to the move curve, the move chart that we were showing, because this is like on the margin one of many little tools to kind of backstop that, the volatility in the bond market. And I guess logic being, right, that this is a few weeks ago, but the USD/JPY cross kind of blowing out to 40 to 50 year lows, and, you know, needing some sort of response to kind of defend the currency from the BOJ and the Japanese government. One of the obvious, you know, ways you could see Japan moving on that and dealing with it is tapping into its, you know, I think it's 1.2 currently trillion of treasury reserves, U.S. treasury reserves. And so we've seen other situations like this in the past with, you know, levered hedge funds in the U.S., right, banks or large corporate counterparties who can come and instead of just outright selling treasuries to raise dollars, or in Japan's case, to defend the yen, you can come and get tap into this repo facility, some kind of repo facility, to access value against the collateral of those treasuries instead of outright selling them. So it's kind of a win-win for both sides. And, you know, we've seen iterations of that trade before. And, you know, this is just I believe the first time that this has happened in this incarnation with the U.S. Supporting and helping the BOJ defend the yen. I think there's been speculation in the past that this has been happening in the background. But this one was kind of outright, directly and explicitly confirmed. But this is just one of many little kind of tools on the margin to, you know, keep move in a reasonable spot, to keep treasury volatility in a reasonable spot, and kind of, you know, you could call it extend and pretend, and I think that's fair. But the reality is that thus far it has been effective, and I think people who have been, you know, sitting there saying like any day now the U.S. is going to have to retrench and call uncle on all this because of these imbalances and these pockets of volatility, you know, just have been nothing but wrong all year. And I think this is just the latest iteration of that. The last piece that I'd highlight here that I kind of circled in red is Bessent saying the FEMA, the FIMA repo facility is an important backstop. We would encourage it to be upsized in the coming months. I think it's interesting because the facility is a Fed facility. So it's not something that the Treasury directly controls. But here you have the Treasury Secretary kind of publicly, you know, expressing his wish and his desire for that backstop to grow, to increase. And that's especially interesting because he's no longer dealing with a recalcitrant counterparty leading the Fed. He's dealing with his boy, Kevin Warsh, sitting in that seat. I think very much worth noting as it relates to a little signpost about how the Fed Treasury relationship, you know, may perhaps be evolving over the coming years.
Yeah. And for those who are unaware, the FEMA repo facility is the Foreign International Monetary Authority's repo facility, which is a standing tool created by the Fed to allow approved foreign central banks and international monetary authorities to temporarily exchange U.S. Treasury securities for U.S. dollars. So essentially a swap line from the Fed to these governments. And on that note, building on all this is, as this is going on, as yields are rising, as the war with Iran is raging on, or the stalemate is raging on, whatever you want to classify it as, it is raging on. We have the fiscal situation here in the United States not getting any better. I believe we just had the largest July budget deficit at negative $432 billion. Interest on U.S. debt rose by $26 billion from last July. It's approaching $120 billion a month, hit $118 in July. So that puts total interest expense for fiscal year 2026 at $1.17 trillion. So I believe that's surpassing national defense and Medicare. I'm reading the Kabbalesi letter tweet for the first time and trying to make sure I get all the details here. But yeah, the fiscal situation is blowing out. We're increasing military spending. I believe we want to expand the budget there by $500 billion. And as we can see here on the right, it looks like Trump is calling Warsh quite frequently since he became the Fed chair as well. And so you have this sort of attempt to manage yields and the volatility on those yields and help out foreign nations to make sure they're not dumping our treasuries. But in the background, we keep running the tab here on the national debt. Should be hitting $40 trillion, I think, within the next couple of weeks. And I think that's a big question on many people's minds, is how do we manage this? What does this mean for the U.S. moving forward as a debtor nation?
Yeah, I mean, look, I believe it was Niall Ferguson who had the famous quote about, historically when that government starts spending more on interest than it does on national defense, you kind of are at the very least entering a meaningful new phase and generally not a good phase for governments historically. To be fair, I don't know that you've ever seen a historical hegemon quite like the U.S. And so I think the quadrillion dollar question is how much incremental room does that give it to maneuver? But like, look, obviously this is like fundamentally unsustainable, and it's, I think something that if you're interested in this show, if you're interested in Bitcoin, this is obviously, it's like being new to you. And it's one of the reasons that I think anyone who is interested in, hard assets, kind of came to this, whether it's Bitcoin or gold or anything else, if you came to that in the first place, it was likely partially because of this. I think it's worth thinking about how like 20 years ago, shortly before a financial crisis, and then even kind of immediately in the wake, I think this kind of curve was like very obvious. It's like very obvious this was happening with the way that U.S. debt to GDP was going, with an aging population transitioning into Social Security and becoming a massive liability from a Medicare perspective, with defense spending ramping up. It was kind of clear if you were paying attention that like this was happening, and so you'd have, kind of lone voices in the wilderness, like Ron Paul calling this out and saying that this is inevitably where we're headed if meaningful changes don't happen. And I think vast majority of people, didn't listen or didn't really care, or, the game was going kind of well enough. So it was, it was somebody else's problem. It was a problem for 20 years from now, 30 years from now, whatever. And, I actually don't think it was like super consensus to talk about this. Fast forward to now, I think especially post COVID, this is, there are a lot of empty suits in Washington still who aren't thinking about this math a lot. But I increasingly think this is like, way more consensus. Like kind of everyone knows that this is what the math says and this is a problem. And so I think there's a danger for like Bitcoiners and gold bugs and hard money people to kind of sit on Twitter and post charts in shock and say, oh, no one's watching this. No one has any idea. We're driving straight off a cliff. I think it's a legitimate concern, but at this point, I think it's much more kind of consensus and understood, and especially among, you know, let's say the triumvirate of Trump, Warsh, and Bessin. I think we can be confident that those guys understand the interest burden on the U.S. debt at this point, right? And I say all that just because it's like, okay, let's like apply a theory of mind to the people who are in charge of this, especially since, you know, two of the three of them are like Druckenmiller proteges, right, and are able to kind of do basic arithmetic. And let's just think about what might they be thinking here and what might the, you know, policy coming out of that, falling out of that be. And I think at the very least we can say collectively, like I look at all these headlines, I look at what Bessent said and has done. I look at what Warsh has said, this headline here about, you know, his communication with the president. I look at, you know, the ongoing math that we all know about. And I'm like, okay, we're not going to hike rates because of the Phillips curve, right? Like we're not in a position anymore where, you know, the consensus of like economics, academia, like means anything in terms of actual policy proposals. Like if it ever did, right? We're like well past the event horizon where, you know, the halcyon golden days of the 90s where you could kind of precisely calibrate the economy on like 25 basis point increments and, you know, have the illusion of tweaking the dials here and there to kind of get the optimal outcome. Like that's done. That's over. So I just think it's this all collectively comes together to me to point in one particular direction, which is like this is going to be managed. And I think it's completely open to debate how well it will be managed. Right. But I think we should just shut the book on the idea that, you know, this is going off a cliff. No one is even trying to drive it. No one's aware of it. And ask yourself, like, if there is someone at the controls now, or a group of people at the controls, maybe you think they have a bad idea of what to do. But like, what do you think they're actually going to do to try to manage this? And, you know, I think there's maybe some stuff we can talk about in the next few slides. But at the very least, you know, perhaps a new Fed Treasury relationship, or we might even say a new Fed Treasury accord, might be kind of in the works for, you know, managing this now very kind of obvious problem.
Yeah, and you don't have this in the chart book, but I want to mention before we get to the next slide, which is AI focus, but as it pertains to like Bitcoin and crypto more broadly, like I think the signal that point to what you just said is they're going to try and manage it. And I do think Bitcoin and stable coins and whether we like it or not, real world asset tokenization is a part of that managed decline or managed facilitation of getting us to the other side of this debt issue, potentially to a new system. You just see the moves that the administration is making, or the agencies below the executive branch right now are making, like the OCC basically opening up the floodgates for Bitcoin and crypto related firms and exchanges to get banking charters. The SEC has come out and said, we're not waiting for Clarity Act. We're going to begin making rulings to make it so that businesses and entrepreneurs can operate with some sense of clarity, even without the Clarity Act specifically. And the Genius Act too, I think Bessent came out last week and said, we're going to be ready January 17th, 2027 to make sure that all the banks and pertinent companies are ready to go to implement the Genius Act. And again, separating what I believe as a Bitcoiner and about sound money and separation of money and state, just objectively looking at the chessboard right now and the moves that are being made, it seems like they are really running full steam ahead, not waiting for Congress and the Senate to get things done to make sure that this infrastructure is ready to go to play a part in this managed situation.
Yeah, I think that's right. The dollar system is transitioning right now, right? Like we are in between systems. It remains to be seen how well that transition will take place or how well it'll work. All the bells and whistles behind it, the mechanisms, you know, what it will ultimately mean. But I think, you know, the operating from the perspective of, you know, 20 that dominated 20 years ago is, I think, just a losing strategy at this point. Like we're well and truly into a shift here. And, you know, I think it's worth asking, like, what types of assets might ultimately collateralize and underpin a new dollar system to the extent that it's being steered in the direction that looks different from a, you know, fully unbacked kind of Fed note and back toward something that looks a little more like a historical traditional dollar over the last couple hundred years. If you were moving in that direction, kind of like how would you do it? And what might it imply for, you know, certain assets that might be useful in making that transition. So remains to be seen, but yeah, I definitely think that is happening.
Yeah. AI. I think the other big chess piece that is being utilized to manage this transition. Obviously, there's a ton of productivity to be gained. It's obviously attracting an amount of capital that would have been unfathomable a decade ago. And I think as this build out continues, we're speed running just sort of like the financialization of this industry. You have compute futures, and I think the biggest headline the last few weeks as it pertains to AI financing is this deal that NVIDIA and a bunch of the larger asset managers, Apollo, BlackRock, Blackstone, Brookfield, Goldman, KKR, came to the table to put together and then announce on CNBC in a consolidated front, which is basically how we're going to finance the build out. And so NVIDIA and all these institutional investor partners gotten together to mobilize over $500 billion of third-party capital to finance this build-out. And NVIDIA, I think it's really unique what they're doing on the chip side to de-risk things for the banks.
Yeah. I mean, there's a ton to say here. I think you could make multiple credible arguments about kind of what this signals about, where we are kind of in the cycle. I think, I probably would skew toward, you can be afraid about how greater securitization and financialization of any asset class, especially at this scale over time, leads to potentially to malinvestment and the need for a wave of liquidations on unprofitable and unreasonable investments. But I think this looks like, we're at the start of the curve, kind of not the end of the curve of if meaningful malinvestment is to come. I think you're maybe something like this would ultimately drive it and support it. But, who can say if that's a year away, multiple years away or whatever. But this to me still looks a little more like kind of the start than the end. That's kind of another debate. I think for our purposes, the couple interesting things to me here are like the way that this links back to everything we talked about is like, if you remember back to Bessent's 3-3-3 plan. So I think it's like, it was $3 gas, 3% unemployment, I think, but then crucially 3% deficit to GDP. So that's, basically cutting in half kind of, or maybe a little less than that, but a meaningful improvement on where the deficit sits to GDP. We just talked about how spending's not slowing down, right? And interest is accelerating. That'll only continue at these rates. Will only continue to be, a larger and larger piece of the overall spending burden. Obviously, defense spending is going up. Boomers aren't getting any younger. Social Security, Medicare, etc. So spending's not slowing down. So that element of the ratio is not going to go down. So the numerator is kind of has that pressure on it. So then, what can you do on the other side? Well, you have the denominator, right? Like you could run it hot. You could have GDP go up meaningfully and have some sort of massive industrial impulse to kind of force that to happen. And then, you're skimming basically tax revenue off a much larger kind of GDP base. And, certainly you can maybe give some help too on the rate side with all the coordination we've just talked about in this episode. But just as it relates to kind of GDP, I think both of these data points we have here, so on the left-hand side, the press release from NVIDIA and the rest of the asset managers, and then on the right-hand side, the latest manufacturing PMI, which is now back to basically close to 2022 highs, levels not seen in over 4 years. In this PR, this NVIDIA PR, there's just an interesting quote from our good friend Uncle Larry at BlackRock saying that the AI build-out will require unprecedented investment and a skilled workforce to turn that investment into the infrastructure that helps to power future growth. So I think like all of, if you're squinting, like it starts to look like all of these things kind of play nicely together for the initiatives that the administration wants to run. And you're starting to see with the PMI evidence that, it is having a noticeable impact in kind of the sclerotic U.S. industrial economy, which is good for another piece that we'll talk about in a second. But this is kind of what you would have to believe, right? If you were Bessent, if you were bullish on the 3-3-3 plan and doing what needs to be done to get there, assuming spending's not slowing down, you would need to see like a titanic, unprecedented wave of new investment into U.S. industry, right? And what better way to do it than the industry that, if you're an AGI maxi, intelligence has infinite demand. What better way to do it than investing in that with the biggest companies in the world? So I think like this is, it's all directionally confirmatory of kind of the strategy that we've been talking about kind of all year. And I think the run it hot playbook is very clear here and not slowing down. But I'll stop there, but I think we should just put a pin specifically in the skilled workforce thing, because I think that's going to be very relevant to think about over the coming months for a few reasons.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that in two slides, but before we get to that, I think the setup for that is this showdown we've been talking about as well. One of the other sub themes of the show over the course of this year is all of this being a massive proxy war for the superpowers that are China in the United States. And if you're reading the headlines, that proxy war seems to be heating up as both countries are trying to silo off their populations and economies from each other in one way or another. And so we have three headlines here. China tightens exit rules over tech security risk. The U.S. is urging Apple not to buy Chinese memory chips. And the U.S. is going to tell their partners they must pick sides in the AI race with China.
Yeah. So, I mean, all fairly self-explanatory. I think the top ones look really interesting as it relates to, you know, not allowing, you know, some of the, basically, if you're strategically valuable to the country as like an AI researcher or, you know, a giga brain who's responsible for one strategic industry or another, like you may not be able to leave the country anymore for a little while. I think that, you know, certainly says a lot about where we are. But, you know, all these I just put on here to indicate, like, you know, the decoupling narrative, the decoupling theme that we've talked about throughout the, you know, this year on the show is, you know, it's not slowing down. It's very clear. And a lot of the fault lines on that particularly seem to be right. The AI race and advanced critical industries, like it'll be AI. We've talked about robotics, robotics export bans and import bans over the past couple of weeks, rare earths, which are obviously an input to both of those industries. So I think you'll continue to see more and more deglobalization and decoupling and fracturing, especially on kind of the most significant industries that are, you know, going to be necessary to establish geopolitical dominance and economic dominance over the coming century. And I think that interestingly also like ties back to the skilled workforce point, right?
Yeah.
In terms of, yeah.
And it's interesting too, because right before we hopped on a record here, I published a TFTC episode with Mark Mitchell from the Honest Poll, previously from Rasmussen. And we talked heavily about the sentiment and how U.S. citizens are feeling about the state of the economy and the Trump administration's initiatives. Iran war, very unpopular, and the economy is the priority that most Americans would like the Trump administration to focus on, the domestic economy. And I think the tenor or the pulse that Mark was relaying to me is that people don't think the economy is going well, but this chart on the left here would say otherwise. I think wage growth is salary growth is something that's been top of mind for people. The K-shaped economy, the permanent underclass has been a meme for many years. And I think when we talk about threading a needle for the Trump administration's initiatives across the board, whether that's international sort of war with Iran, if that's China versus the US, if it's the AI build out, the reindustrialization, really need to get proof in the pudding that things are working. And I was shocked to see this chart, just that the wage growth for different levels of wealth in the United States, and it looks like lower, middle, and higher incomes, excluding the top 5%, are on the way up, trending up, while top 5% wage growth or salary growth is falling, which would signal that maybe this reindustrialization and this AI build out is beginning to manifest in higher wages for lower income Americans.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an interesting confluence of data points at the very least, right? Like, I think it's tough to call a future, you know, not going to necessarily extrapolate that chart continues to look exactly the same, but that's kind of like that's what you would want to see if you were running this playbook, right? You'd want to see PMI meaningfully picking up. You'd want to see, you know, national champions of major industries investing massive amounts into, you know, the most important industrial theme in a century. You would generally like to have some sort of increasing bifurcation between your economy and the other major superpower economy, and thereby create perhaps some artificial stimulus to your national champions. Collectively, like, what's the result of that? Well, it's what Larry Fink was alluding to, right? The need for what falls out of that is the need for, you know, more skilled trades, more people in with high paying skilled workforce jobs to build all that out for AI, robotics, reindustrialization broadly. And so I think all of that looks to be going in like a certain direction. And then I look at from a couple of weeks ago, there's a headline on Elon Musk apparently coming back to the table, despite his kayfabe fight with Trump last year, to spend, you know, $100 million or more on to boost Republican turnout in the midterms. And, you know, I'll defer to guys like Mark on whether that's going to work or what, you know, sentiment actually looks like on the ground. But all of that collectively comes together to me to just point to like an interesting possible like counter consensus outcome in November. I think it's like everyone's just assuming that, you know, it's going to be an absolute Republican bloodbath in the fall. And it very well may be, just given like that's usually how it works for the incumbent party in midterms. But it's just a lot of interesting data points if you're, you know, fully kind of falling into line with that consensus narrative. And I think it's worth watching at the very least into the fall.
Yeah. Midterms coming up, summer doldrums winding down. And we will end it with Bitcoin Talk, Macroscope. Great follow if you don't follow. I'm just highlighting a couple of things here. Tudor Investment, Paul Tudor Jones, increased his IBIT shares. So it's an increase from 579,083 shares to 688,529. So almost a 20% increase in his position there. And then Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, Mubadala, reported owning 14.7 million shares of IBIT on June 30th. Valued at almost $500 million, unchanged from the previous quarter. And it's their second largest holding in their entire 13F filing for Mubadala. And then in a filing last week as well, Abu Dhabi Investment Council, which is another sovereign wealth fund in the region, reported owning 8.2 million shares of IBIT, which is also unchanged from the previous quarter. So the IBIT position is by far the largest for ADIC and their entire 13F filings in the Middle East. Coming into Bitcoin in a big way, Paul Tudor Jones increasing his position. And at the same time, we have Bitcoin's rolling 1 month realized volatility, I believe, at all-time lows. Bitcoin's trading like a stable coin right now. I was actually looking at it. We've been basically in a $4,000 range for $5,000 range since June 2nd. So the summer of coil, if you will.
Yeah. I think, you know, these are probably fairly self-explanatory, but, PTJ upping his allocation is always, you know, something you generally like to see. Now that's as of June 30th. So maybe he's brought it back down again, but, you know, positive signal there. But then also, I just thought it was really interesting to see Abu Dhabi hold pat on Bitcoin through Q2, despite all of the kind of ongoing volatility in the region and, you know, what that's done for oil revenues and how that has flowed through to the way that the sovereigns in the region have had to kind of manage reserves. There was some speculation, I think, decently well-founded, that was a big headwind to gold in Q1 and Q2, you know, selling to offset some lost revenue. And I think it's interesting in contrast that, Bitcoin, you know, was held pat there. Now it's a much smaller allocation, most likely. So may or may not have made a difference, but that's at least kind of the, you know, directionally what you'd like to see. And then, of course, like on the volatility piece, like I think if we're not at all-time lows, it's close. I think clearly down channel and volatility for the last few years. And again, this is like, not going to tell you, like, we're not going to have another leg down, but that's what you want to see in accumulation zone, right? Is big buyers stepping in or kind of holding pat and then volatility just coming down and down and down and getting into that kind of coiled spring territory. So generally with the coiled springs, you eventually spring hard and fast one way or the other. So we can officially say Bitcoin will either go up or go down from here. But either way, this is the setup you generally like to see to presage the start of a new bull run.
Yeah. And with that, we'll see you guys next week.